Launch your medical career with zero to little debt with the Army's Health Professions Scholarship Program. HPSP is one of the most comprehensive scholarships available in the healthcare field. The Health Professions Scholarship could be great for those pursuing a career in one of these fields: medical, including osteopathy, dental, veterinary, nursing, counseling and clinical psychology, and optometry. For more information, visit goarmy.com/HPSP.
Good morning and welcome to the AMED Effect podcast, where we discuss the causes and effects of Army medicine opportunities. Before we jump into episode 9, I need for everybody to do me a favor. First, like the podcast so you can stay up to date on the latest episodes and release dates. Second, leave a comment or ask a question so we know how we're doing, things that you would like to hear, things that you all would like to see, or some content that we should be covering. Last but not least, share the show with someone who you may know that may find the content that we're providing useful for them. Now, let's get into episode 9. Today on the AMED Effect, I have the pleasure of speaking with Captain Donna Weekly. I will cover her journey in the U.S. Army as a perioperative nurse, life inside the service as a wife and a mother, along with her plans in the future with the Army and after retirement. Good morning, Captain Weekly. How are you doing today?
Good morning. I'm well. How are you?
I'm good. Can't complain at all. It feels good outside. And we're getting the week off to a good start. So another episode is episode 9. So first, thank you for participating and coming through and just being a part of the podcast and telling your story as well.
Thank you for the opportunity.
No problem at all. If you can you please give the listeners and the viewers a little bit more background on your current position and the roles and responsibilities as the assistant operations officer at the Medical and Chaplain Recruiting Brigade?
Sure. So I will tell you, it's no different than any traditional S3 officer. I do a lot of the day-to-day operations when it comes to our production overall with our recruiting. Okay. I also work as the plans officer as well, so a lot of the op orders that come out of the brigade, the long-range planning and whatnot. However, what's a little bit unique is because I am a perioperative nurse, I've used my expertise and experience as a nurse to assist the brigade in ways outside of a traditional planner or ops officer.
Okay.
By serving as a nurse corps SME when needed, doing a bit of the travel and things like this podcast today. So
So when you say SME, for those who don't know, subject matter expert, so do you have the opportunity to go out to speak with students and tell them about all of the opportunities that the Army has to provide?
Yes, and actually that's the most, I think, fulfilling thing that I've gotten to do for this job. Mm-hmm. It was really neat to be a nurse and take on operations and get a handle of operations or all the planning aspects and things that traditionally nurses don't do.
Okay.
I would say we're not traditionally staff officers, especially not at this captain rank. Mm-hmm. But one of the greatest things that I discovered while being here is that ability to reach back out and kind of share my story and interact with people that may not know about the Army and what it has to offer.
Right, yeah. What's the saying? They say, each one teach one until you reach one.
Something like that.
Now, where are you originally from? And what was life for Captain Weekly growing up?
So, so I'm originally from Long Branch, New Jersey. I doubt anybody really knows about it. It's kind of on the shore, not Jersey Shore.
Okay.
But it is on the shore. But unfortunately, my mother was a single mother. She had four children, kind of struggled a bit, so it became a little bit expensive to live where we did in New Jersey.
Right.
We moved down south, relocated to Nashville, Tennessee, which is where I kind of grew up. Initially living with my great-grandmother till my mom got on her feet, and then throughout high school, I remained there. And then that's where I met my ROTC instructors in high school, and kind of that's where my Army career started, is there in high school.
So you said Nashville, Tennessee, Antioch area or a different area?
No, like Nashville proper, which I guess is like Nash Vegas.
Okay.
It wasn't that back then. It, like I said, honestly, was an opportunity for my mom to kind of get herself on her feet because about 20 years ago, not saying how old I am, but 20 years ago or so, that area was pretty much a cheaper area to live.
Okay.
Low cost of living area. It wasn't what you see it to be now.
Because the construction's probably was going on 20 years ago.
I don't even know if we had
that. And there's still construction going on now. So my sister lives in Nashville, so I'm down there pretty frequently. So I've seen the growth of Nashville over the time that she has been there as well. Now, as children growing up, we have dreams and aspirations to be athletes, musicians, the president of the United States, police officers, teachers, and other things. My question to you, what did Captain Weekly grow up wanting to be as a child?
Number one, I always tell people it was a Power Ranger. It was going to be the Pink Power Ranger. However, of course, you know, you grow up and you realize that's not a thing.
Uh-huh.
I will tell you honestly, and I had to, going through a recent professional program process, like applying for that, I had to really think back and say, you know, how did I get to that point? And I realized growing up, I really didn't think I was going to be much of anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I say that to mean just whoever I was surrounded by, I can't really say they had professional careers or things like that to where I could really aspire to be like anyone I was seeing.
Right, got
you. So for the most part, at best, it was just like, okay, let me finish high school.
Mm-hmm. Now, you brought this up, and I was going to ask you, which is my next question, but you brought up your ROTC instructor. While you were in high school, were you were part of the JROTC program? Okay. So you had a desire at an early age to become a soldier, or was it just, let me jump into the ROTC program, it's just a class that I could have and take?
Right. So initially, it was like just an open house at the high school. I believe they had like a little, some kind of advertisement, and they actually showed people, I think it was like rappelling, like something super adventurous, right? And I'm from the inner city, so I'm like, okay, this looks cool. It's like something I hadn't done.
Uh-huh.
So initially it was more so just that, just the kind of, let me see what this is about. It wasn't that I was joining because I knew I wanted to be a soldier.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't until while in high school, I was already in JROTC, and then September 11th happened.
Okay.
And then that Power Ranger inside of me came back like, you know what, I got to suit up. As soon as I'm old enough, I got to suit up. I got to go out there and get the bad guys.
Uh-huh.
Just really wanted to save, like, you know, the American citizens. But
right.
It wasn't initially like I knew I wanted to be a soldier growing up, and that's why I joined.
So let's talk about the September 11th situation. But before we get there, you made a statement or a quote that I have found. And in your words, you said that you attribute your success to your mother, who ensured you were given the best education and opportunities growing up. What are some of those things that your mother did to ensure that you received those best education and opportunities?
So as I said, my mom kind of struggled. She was a single mom. She herself did not go to college. I would say she had an average job at best, probably minimum wage or somewhere near that, raising four kids. But she knew her limitations.
Right.
And I'll tell you, she would always apply for like the lottery. I think it was like a lottery program for magnet schools, trying to get me in the best of schools. And I remembered getting into this one middle magnet school for gifted kids. However, we were kind of poor, right? So it was in the inner city of Nashville at the time. I think it was called Meg's Magnet. And I literally purposely bombed out.
Oh, yeah.
And I bombed out because it pulled me with other kids that were high-achieving kids, but they came from maybe better backgrounds.
Uh-huh.
And I just couldn't do it. But my mom was, like, driving her old-school Cadillac. And I want to say it was a blue Cadillac, and, like, one panel was red because we were, a little struggling there, you know, so that wasn't her priority.
Uh-huh.
But she would pull up to that Meg's Magnet because she had to get me there for me to be able to go to that school.
Right.
And I would be like, oh, here she comes. You know, everybody else's parents are in the better cars or this, and I'm like, here's my mom. And this, you know, couldn't pick.
Right.
It was just those small things. And then, you know, maybe kids always pointing those things out. So I literally, like, filled myself out. And my mom still wouldn't give up. So then in high school, she got me into school. I mean, it was one of the first schools that had an IB program. It's like International Baccalaureate Program.
Uh-huh.
Essentially, you got college classes your first 2 years of high school. I'm sorry, your last two years of high school. Once again, her knowing her limitations, I had a friend coming out of middle school, lived up in the country, couldn't be more different than me.
Uh-huh.
And her mom stepped up and was like, I know this program will be a lot. My mom has a lot on her plate. And she said, you know, if you don't care, she can live with us or stay with us so we can get her through the schoolwork.
Uh-huh.
And that now as an adult and as a mother myself, I now realize what it must have taken for her to do that and right. the pride she had to put down. Because my mom was not the homework helper. You didn't want to ask my mama for help with homework. That's not what you wanted to right. do. But just her knowing then that that's what she needed to do for my best future. And I did. I moved in with that family way up in the country. I mean, it was on a farm. They had goats, quarter horses, chickens. I mean, I'm just this, like, black girl from the inner city. And you're I'm like now up in the hills. Like, what is going on? Right. But, yes, the family that let me stay with them and that the girl that mm-hmm. I stay with to this day is, like, one of my best friends. And she knows, like, how impactful that was for my life and the trajectory of my life to be able okay. to do that.
Man, let's give a round of applause to moms.
Yeah, shout out to moms.
And
for
let's
that.
Give one to the friend and her mother yes. for giving you those opportunities.
Yes. It definitely did, like I said, change the trajectory. Now that I'm looking back on those things that I didn't see then, I see them now.
Mm-hmm. Good deal. Now, back to the September 11th for me, which is this probably aged me. Now, I was a freshman in college at Western Kentucky University when I learned about the attacks. Being a military brat, I understood what could be coming, what could come up next from these attacks that were going on. When you learned about the attacks, you said that you felt an immense sense of duty to your country mm-hmm. and a desire to make a difference. It went right back to that power, pink Power Ranger mode. Mm-hmm. What about the 9/11 attacks led you to your decision to join the Army?
So as I said, I had already been in JROTC at this point, and I want to say that day, I feel like I had on my pickle suit, like we had those, like, the old school green dress uniforms. You know, you had to dress up.
I had to wear it, too, once a week.
Right, and it was just, like, such a sense of pride and feeling like I need to protect these citizens. Like, uh-huh. I'm all of maybe 90 pounds at this point. But, you know, I wasn't having it. And those things now, looking back, it is. It's just that, mm-hmm. like, duty that was already in me, that appreciation for the country that I live in, and me feeling like I've got inside of me something mm-hmm. strong enough that maybe other people don't, that I'll be the one to go up front. Okay. So I wasn't old enough. I was clearly in high school, but I was like, you know what? The day that I can, I'm going to be over there. Like, I got to do something.
Got to make it happen. Now, when you initially joined the Army, did you take the enlisted route or did you go the officer route? Which it's probably a silly question mm-hmm. because I think you took the enlisted route. But what was your AOC when you first joined?
Counterintelligence.
Okay.
So my mom was really big on that. I will say she was hesitant about service because the only thing she knew is her mother's brother passed away in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. He was killed in action.
Okay.
So I would say, like, she wasn't very supportive of it. Mm-hmm. So the only way that she would let me do it is she was like, okay, you're not going to just join, and what is the impact that it's going to give to you, right? So she made sure, like, she was talking to the recruiter once I finally kind of, you know, grinded her down and letting me do it because I joined at 17. She had a sign for me to do it. I ambushed her with the recruiter at the house. you know, she just wanted to make sure that whatever job I was doing, it was going to be something, since she figured I wasn't going to college straight after high school.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Good deal. So how did you like doing counterintelligence?
Let me talk about the finance that I did after that.
Okay.
So, yes, understood. I came in as counterintelligence. And then a couple years, I want to say it was like 3 years down the line, I actually became a finance soldier.
Okay.
And I'll give you a little bit of backstory, and that's what I always try and tell people. Sometimes when things happen in your life that you may think are negatives, you don't know the positive is going to be down the line. And that's what I would tell that self.
Okay.
So as I stated, I came in for counterintelligence, signed at 17. I was still in high school. Part of that job, you would have to go away. I believe it was in, I won't disclose where it is, but basically, essentially, there was an additional part of the training where I was going to have to learn Arabic.
Gotcha.
And I tested for that. You know, I had to secure my top secret security clearance, all that to get this job. So for the year prior to me leaving high school, I'm assigned to this unit. And it's almost time for me to go. I've graduated high school, and it was the summer after graduating high school. And I go take a bus trip back to New Jersey to tell everybody bye, because I'm going to be gone for quite a while.
Right.
Start feeling very sick and nauseous on this bus ride. Long story short, that is now my 18-year-old son.
Oh, okay.
I was pregnant with him. So now I was like, what? I'm supposed to be leaving for basic training in like 2 weeks. I'm going to tell everybody bye, and now I find out that I'm pregnant. And at 17.
Okay.
So with that, I clearly had to go through the whole like pregnancy process. They had to withhold me leaving for training. Mm-hmm. After having my son, I was sent off to training. And by the time I finished my basic training, they told me, hey, it's been such a long time since you've enlisted, until you've actually completed AIT. So at this point, if you don't go to some school right now that's shorter than that school, we'll have to discharge you.
Oh, wow.
So I'm like, call my mom. I had just finished basic training, did all this hard work. And they're like, well, we got a cook school here because I was at Fort Jackson. They're like, you want to be a cook? And, you know, it would have been probably a fabulous career. However, I'm not that good at cooking. And my mom finds, I'm like just casually calling her like, hey, mom, you know, they're saying if I don't go to AIT right this minute in a short one, they're going to have to release me because it's been so long without me having my job completed.
Right.
And my mom was like, you know, that's not what I let you sign up for. It's not happening. Now, my mom doesn't really have a military connection, so she's up at Fort Jackson, and she's got to tell them something, which what I'm not going to do and what I am going to do. So that's how I ended up in finance. She was like, okay, well, if we're going to do this, it's got to be something that she was still okay with, and it was finance.
Finance, okay. Mm-hmm. Good deal. So your first duty assignment after basic training and after you went through your pregnancy, where did you land your first duty assignment at?
They used to call it Fort Couch at the home because I joined as an enlisted soldier through the National Guard. So I've done a little bit of everything in the Army. So I came in as a National Guard soldier, which is what I was getting back to for 2 years or 3 years. I drilled that counterintelligence unit and hadn't yet completed the AIT. So now I've gone to basic, gone to AIT, finished my career as a finance soldier, and came back to what I thought was going to be Fort Couch. That's what the active duty soldiers told me at basic. Mm-hmm. However, maybe 2 weeks after I had gotten home, I was on a flight to Germany. So that's the cool thing about the Army. Like, I'm all of 18 at this point, maybe 19, and they're like, hey, we need you to meet your unit. That was when I first met them at the airport on the way to Germany.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. Mannheim, actually. It was Spinelli Barracks. So really cool.
Well, my pops was in. We did Illesheim and Baumholder.
I've heard of those. But, yeah, it's definitely Mannheim. Like super young. My friends are maybe at the Burger King back at home, who knows where. And I'm like on a Lufthansa flight going to Europe. It was wild.
Now, deployments is one thing about the Army that almost all soldiers will have to face. Where have you deployed and how was your experience in a deployed state?
So back to, you know, I got to fulfill that duty that I said I was going to do. And I would say as an enlisted soldier, I had a feeling. Every time someone found out I'm in the military and they're like, hey, so how was, because it was the height of the war. You know, they would ask me about deployment. I'm like, I've never been because I've gone to Germany. Now I've gone back to Germany again. So I actually volunteered. I swapped with another unit, another member from a different unit. They didn't want to go at the time. And I said, I want to go. And I volunteered to go to Baghdad, Iraq, as a finance soldier.
Okay.
And when I tell you, my first couple of hours in theater, you know, it was definitely, I was like, I need to call my mama. You know, me and my mama close. I'm like, hey, just want to let you know, like, it's actually an actual war. You know, she's like what did you think? Right? Yeah. You know, but once again, I think I was probably like 19 still, somewhere around there. And I'm like, you know, like, I actually hear gunfire, like, right now. Like, right now, I'm still on the flight line.
Right.
Like, they're shooting right now. I can hear it. And she's, like, freaking out, whatnot. And we flew into, like, a major base. And then from there was a change of plans. Once again, like I tell people, don't worry about how life changes on you. Mm-hmm. Don't get so twist-tied up about it because it was the most beautiful experience, though. Initially, I would have been in the green zone at a larger FOB. But last minute, they're like, hey, we need a couple of you all to do what are called pay missions. So they're like, you guys hang here. We're going to send you somewhere else. And we did. I went to a smaller FOB, and I spent my deployment doing pay missions.
Okay.
So essentially flying around most time to small, austere locations to pay soldiers that were not at the main base. And looking back now, it is like one of the greatest experiences I've had, one of the biggest challenges I've had, but it has definitely made me the person that I am today.
Good deal. Now, after you being enlisted into the Army, you end up coming over to the medical side. What are some pivotal moments or key events that led to your decision to become a healthcare provider in the Army?
So it was actually out of that deployment. I had just gotten back from like a mission, and that was like the best thing, like coming back from missions and then being back at my FOB where I was stationed. And I'm calling my grandma. My grandma, I'm extremely close with her. And I remember her talking to me about her doctor's appointment, and she's like, having an issue with her doctor, but I was like, well, you should let him know, you know? And she was like, no, I don't want him to be mad at me. And I was not understanding. I'm like, why would you expect the doctor to be mad at you? And number two, like, you're grown.
Right.
You're paying for this. This is wild. Like, just tell him. Mm-hmm. And she just had so much, like, fear in her voice. So I remember, like, just casually saying, well, you know what? I'm going to have to be a doctor and take care of you myself. Mm-hmm. You know, that's how I felt about it. Like,
right. What
are we doing? And here I am, like, on, you know, the little internet back then. And I literally started looking it up and started to try and find out the requirements because I didn't know anybody that had a career like that. So I'm just, like, literally whatever internet there was back then, like, Googling, like, pretty much how to be a doctor.
Right.
And then I started looking into it. And then I started to realize it was also important for me to not what I assumed to be, that I now know is not true, a pill pusher. I was like, I don't want to just, you know, go to school that didn't, like, push pills on people and with all the little knowledge that I had at the time about healthcare. So then I started to look in osteopathic medicine and DO schools. And then from there, I think a little bit of hesitancy came in, like, wait, this is a lot. So I started to find out about nurse practitioners. So back then, I assumed they were exactly the same, a nurse practitioner and a physician.
Right.
So I was like, I'll just do this. So this way I could do 4 years. I could commission through ROTC.
Mm-hmm.
And then if I do well in it, because it was that whole thing, I don't even know if I could do this, right? This seems like a lot. Well, if I succeed, then I can, you know, stair step it up to become a nurse practitioner. And then that's what I did on my 2-week R&R. I went back to the community college and applied. Where other people were, like, taking their vacation and chilling for their 2 weeks from deployment, I went back, filled out my application, and paid my application fee for school.
For school. I was like, I'm going back to
school. I get back.
I understand that. So is the transition from one AOC to another a difficult process? And if it is, talk about how you were able to get through that.
I wouldn't say it's difficult. It's all about a mindset and being open to different things and understanding being a nurse is being a nurse. Being an operations officer is an operations officer. And as long as you can understand that and then just pull from, there's things that I've learned as a nurse, like the multitasking or learning to deal with different personalities and suspenses, whether they're medication suspenses, understanding the urgency of some things and prioritizing things. Then you bring that into your job as an ops officer. And then now I've carried that into, okay, how can I take planning with even what I'm doing as an SME?
Mm-hmm.
How can I utilize not just trying to reach people, but using that reach in a way that it benefits this brigade?
Right.
So just pulling the best out of everything, seeing how you can use it in different jobs.
Okay. Now, let's talk about school for a minute. You said you came back, you applied, you paid for school. Where did you end up attending undergrad school at?
So, because like I said, when I want to do things, I'm going to do it. Applied, I think it was 2 weeks after deployment, I was sitting at the community college.
Mm-hmm.
Then I just figured, okay, I'm just going to talk to these ROTC people. I've done all my research when I was deployed, and I'm going to start ROTC. However, not having a lot of peers doing anything like that or any actual guidance, when I went to speak to the ROTC department, it was actually at Georgia Tech. Number one, they were saying, we don't have nursing here.
Okay.
So you'd have to go to a different college for that, and then we would be your satellite school.
Okay.
Okay, no problem. They said, you also have to have 30 credit hours. I didn't have that. As I stated, I think I had gotten back home in January and started like 2 weeks after coming back, started college. And they're like, you need 30 credit hours by fall. So I was like, oh, okay. So the community college was, they had a limit on how much you could do, a cap on hours.
Right, yeah.
But what I essentially did was apply to do a dual program through the community college and the university so that I could take an overload of classes. And that's what I did. I just did the grinder. Yeah, like, I was doing mini-mesters. I did A&P in, like, 4 weeks. I think they were, like, mini-mesters. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just really knew what I desired to do. And it was like, okay, I need 30 hours. Then I'll have the 30 hours. And I did.
That's good right there. A round of applause for Captain Wiggly going in there getting those 30 hours like that. That's not easy, y'all. That is not easy at all.
Are you looking to pursue a successful healthcare career at one of the largest and most advanced medical facilities in the country? If so, look no further. The U.S. Army is here. Visit goarmy.com/AMED to learn how you can serve soldiers, their families, military retirees, and at times, the general public while providing meaningful service.
And if you guys are interested in learning more about the AMED department or the Army Medical Department, make sure that you follow that website. Now, on previous episodes, I've had the opportunity to talk about the Health Professions Scholarship Program and how beneficial the program is for students looking to have a career in the medical field. I guess my first question to you is, are you a former recipient of the HPSP program?
No, because I'm Captain Weekly and I want to do my own thing.
Okay.
So although I was eligible for even a nurse course scholarship, ROTC scholarship, I was like, I want control of what I want to do. And being that I had come in from the reserve side, I was unsure of what active duty would be like. And it was like, my only experience at that point was like going over to Germany for a bit and then the deployment with 3rd ID. I was with their sustainment brigade. So that was my assumption of active duty.
Okay.
So I wanted that ability to choose. So I did not take any of that. I actually did a program called the Simultaneous Membership Program, sorry, SMP, okay. Where you essentially drill with a guard or reserve unit. You'll get a small paycheck while you do it. You'll get some leadership experience while in ROTC, and then you're not held to any kind of like contract.
Okay, good deal right there. So I have to look that program up. And
that's a really good program. A lot of people don't know about it.
Okay, so they still do offer that program.
Mm-hmm. They
do. Good deal. Now, looking back on your decision to take that program over HPSP, do you wish you could do it over, or are you happy with the route that you took?
I'm very happy with the route that I took. It actually, like I said, allowed me, so once a month I would drill with that reserve unit, but I would function as a cadet within that unit, and I was actually the training officer. So it kind of gave me that exposure and people already holding you to that standard of at least a second lieutenant out the gate. So I think that helped me get a little leg up on my peers, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm.
Yes, definitely makes a lot of sense. Now, you go out, you speak to students as a SME. What advice would you give, and advice that you are currently give to those students who are on the fence about wanting to utilize the Health Professions Scholarship Program?
Number one of the biggest things I tell people now is don't leave money on the table. I mean, let's start with that. I'm just going to be honest.
She finance
a lot
now.
Of dollars,
finance.
Right? Let's talk about the finances there. Don't leave money on the table. Also, just be open to experiences, because a lot of times what will happen is people get jaded because they've heard of other people's experiences. Mm-hmm. But your experience is your own, and you control that. So, like I said, take advantage of that. Where I had to deal with, okay, I'm not receiving that additional income. So I was, like, trying to figure out life and essentially riding a struggle bus. A lot of ramen noodles,
right.
Bologna sandwiches, hot dogs, you know.
Life of a college
I could have been eating a little bit better.
Right.
maybe had a couple of Starbucks coffees. So, and that frees up time for people to do better in their coursework when finances are not at the top of your head.
Right.
And then with that, you know you're locked into your career because they have a shared interest in you completing your degree or education program as well, because they're expecting you to come out on the back end.
Right. And then on top of that, also having a job waiting for you when you come out as well. So I know a lot of college students are like, well, where am I going to work? Can I find a place to work? So on and so forth.
Correct.
Now, let's talk about the Nurse Corps. The Nurse Corps has 5 specialties that soldiers can take on. They are critical care, mental health, perioperative, emergency trauma, gynecology, and obstetrics. You decided to go into the perioperative route. Explain to listeners what the roles and responsibilities of a perioperative nurse is.
Chaos coordinator. No, so I'll tell you, it's like a running joke within the nursing community. They feel as though all we do is DJ. Mm-hmm. We DJ. And that's what they imagine, that we hide out in the OR. And also that they see us like always prep the patients. That's about the extent of what they see. But actually, as a perioperative nurse, I work very closely with surgeons to ensure that the cases go well for the patient. The patient has the best overall outcomes, whether that's ensuring that supplies are ordered, equipment is processed and prepared in time for those procedures. Also, like I said, in the room, managing everything, whether it's their surgical techs, helping them out, because they're all scrubbed in, and they're scrubbed in for hours at a time. Mm-hmm. You are their eyes. You are their ears. When emergencies happen, you're the one first out the door, the first one calling for help. And like I said, just that support, it's an overall team,
right,
more so than a lot of the other specialties you get with that. I was plastic surgery, robotic surgery, and transplant, and you really get to build, I guess, like almost like a football team, how they know they're passing the play to you, you're delivering overall, we're bringing the touchdown in right. together.
So everybody has a role mm-hmm. that they have to play in order mm-hmm. for us to be able to get to the end goal. Now, being a part of a surgical team is a huge responsibility. Share some experiences from your journey and how did the Army support you through it?
One of the biggest things, like I said, what's a little bit different about or unique and cool about doing it in the Army versus on the outside, and I didn't realize that time now I went out to try and do a PRN position, mm-hmm. is coming out the gate, you'll get into an actual residency. They sent me to San Antonio, Texas for 4 months.
Okay.
I just assumed that's how it was on the outside. It's not. Seen where they literally have had nurses show up from other specialties and say, hey, sit here on the computer, kind of just bang through these modules, and then that makes you a perioperative nurse.
Right.
We had extensive training, didactic training, hands-on training, small cohort of us to really understand and learn the craft beyond just the actions you're doing, but all the methodology behind it as well. Then coming into the OR, typically as a new OR nurse, you would just circulate. Mm-hmm. Not only were we circulating, we were given the opportunities. If you wanted to learn scrubbing and really get to learn from your surgical techs, I've learned so much from them. A lot of them have done this for years. That ability, because we're military and peers in a way, mm-hmm. that day-to-day dialogue with your surgeon, really getting that backstory of why we're doing what we're doing and how he or she expects the procedures to go, and you really getting to understand it from their eyes. The other thing, too, is just the leadership experiences. So out the gate, I think I circulated it just under a year, and they're like, okay, now which service do you want to be in charge of? That's not happening outside. They were like, you want to do robotics? I mean, I had a multi-million dollar budget.
Oh,
I'm buying equipment, making sure these robots are serviced, ensuring that even the residents coming in, medical students, other nurses, surge techs are being trained up on this equipment. Just thought this was normal until, like I said, now knowing the outside and people are like, you did what?
Right.
And at the Walter Reed of all places. So, yeah, they're definitely there to grow you as a leader. You're not just there working as a, you know, nurse.
Okay. So, and you kind of, you spoke on it, but my next question was going to be about the different residencies that the U.S. Army provides in their locations. So you were in San Antonio, you said Walter Reed?
Walter Reed is where I actually worked.
Okay.
As both a med-surg nurse, assistant manager essentially, and then OR nurse. But the residency was actually in San Antonio, Texas at BAMC.
BAMC, okay. So that's what I was going to say. Cause I was like, Walter Reed's in mm-hmm. East Coast, right?
But that's the neat thing about it. So right. for 4 months, I was put in a luxury apartment,
mm-hmm.
you know, so I could study well.
Good.
living good. You know, on the government's dime, I didn't have to relocate my family,
uh-huh.
but they were able to come and visit.
Right.
But it was a good time to really, really just understand what it was to be a perioperative nurse and be prepared to get my certification.
Now, being down there at BAMC doing doing your residency training, did you also have the opportunity to work or go over and visit the Center of the Intrepid?
I did not.
Okay.
Because I will tell you, like I said, the residency was pretty intense.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of didactic training. We actually got a certification down in sterile processing, which is unique. I wouldn't say most OR nurses would have that on the outside, but we actually had a certification where we did, I believe it was 80 hours or so in sterile processing. So pretty busy. And then the river walk in right. those areas kept me busy on my downtime. So that's the cool thing about the Army, too. They take you to places and spaces and up to you to make the best of it. So I had a couple of trips to Houston, some great times there, and some other areas that would give us a pass mm-hmm. at times. Austin, Texas,
right.
some of the surrounding cities.
Okay. Did you ever try some boudin while you were out there?
No.
No? Okay, no.
I think I had fried alligator at some kind of festival.
Okay. I know boudin. They were real crazy about the boudin down there in Texas. I got a partner who's from San mm-hmm. Antonio, so that's all he
kolaches,
talks about.
Kolaches. I think that's what it's called. Don't kill me now. I don't know if it's kolaches. I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
But it is a foodie town.
Yeah. It is a foodie town for sure. So did you like the larger residency locations versus the smaller community hospitals? I know some people have their preference. I think when I spoke with the brigade commander, she had mentioned that she liked the community hospital a little bit more. So what about you? Or did you have you had the experience at a smaller hospital?
I have. So I would say I like the larger ones. Most recently, so one thing that I do in this role, being that I'm not doing direct patient care, is I make it a point to go out to some of our facilities to just upkeep my skills. So I actually went out to Tacoma, Washington, to Madigan Hospital, which is one of the smaller. I would say it's still large for one of the Army facilities, but smaller when you look at Walter Reed or BAMC. And I absolutely prefer like the larger facilities because they're typically in larger facilities because they're typically in the larger cities. Yeah. So just more exploring.
Yeah, city girl. So
I'm a city girl now. I was not.
Not well. Nashville, New Jersey. Still kind of, but no.
They were smaller. So smallest. Long Branch, I could probably walk the whole thing in an hour's time. And then Nashville, like I said, I lived in Nashville when it was not Nash Vegas.
Gotcha.
So much of nothing going on. I think we had the Grand Ole Opry, which is great, but that was probably about it.
Still out there. So as after you finish residency training, well, I'm pretty sure during your residency training, you participated in some of the planning and organizing for a upcoming surgery. Do you remember your first time, and what was that experience like for you?
So even with all that residency, I can't remember the exact initial like procedure I would have done, but I will tell you, the first couple of weeks or months, I was just like, oh, dear God. Oh, I don't think I know what I'm doing. I mean, I was clearly doing it. And I will tell you, that is the beauty of being in the Army, because they know. Mm-hmm. One thing that people don't understand is a lot of the military facilities have civilians, GS, civilian employees. Those nurses have been nurses for years. They are the most amazing people, and they are there to grow us, especially as junior officers. They know we don't know.
Right.
And they are right there behind you, like, get back in there. I mean, if they're literally, like, kind of, like, walking you through it until you can run.
Okay.
So that is a beautiful thing, because at first I was just like, oh, dear God. Yeah, no clue. Okay. And then before you know, one day you're just, like, magically doing everything on your own, like, just no sweat.
Now, how did you, if you remember, how did you prepare for that day? And what emotions were kind of like going through you, running through you at that time when you were leading up to that first operation?
So I would do what we were trained to do in residency. So, and with anything new, right, you want to prepare yourself. So you typically know what case you're working the next day. You would look up that procedure, whether you got to look at a YouTube video, you know, you're looking through the book, thumbing through it, trying to imagine the steps or reach back to when you may have been exposed to it in residency, because that's part of it. They have you circulate through a variety of cases so you can at least get, you know, a first pass at it. Right. It's not new to you. But like I said, that preparation, my first couple of months in the OR, they were long days and nights because I just didn't know it yet. So the night before, trying to ensure that I have all my equipment before I left, like, you know, laying everything out. Like, if it's implants that were put in, do I have my implants? Or you're like checking 50 times.
Right.
Is it the correct size? Reaching, communicating with that surgeon, your surgical team. My surgical techs helped me grow up as an OR nurse. Okay. You know, they're like, ma'am, that's not what this is. It's this. Or that's not how you do that. That's not even how you put this equipment together. And just having an open mind to learn from everyone that's part of that team. But yeah, definitely nerve-wracking for the first couple of months. I was like kind of in a daze, like, I think they're going to let me go.
Right. Like, am I doing this right?
I'm doing this right. I think they're going to, anytime they call me your name, like, am I going to let go? They're going to send me back to the med-surg ward. And then, like I said, at the end of it, being the leader of all these different services.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, this is probably a silly question, but the operating room can be very intimidating, be a very intimidating environment. How has planning and organizing for an operation become easier after years of practice? I know you don't, you know, currently work in that field right now?
I do, though. So that's one neat thing.
Okay.
Is with us in these broadening roles, you can typically have the permission to work in a PRN status. Oh. So I actually do have a job PRN at the University of Louisville's hospital in the city.
Oh, okay, okay. Mm-hmm. So, has planning and preparing for those surgeries become easier for you after those years of practice?
Absolutely.
Are you still checking to make sure, you know, two and three times, making sure that everything is, that you have everything prepared?
I mean, I still do thorough checks because at the end of the day, patient safety is important to me.
Right.
And patients having a great experience and best outcomes. But I am confident in what I'm doing. And that's a lot of that training that I've had from the Army. I stepped on the outside. I was like, oh, this is like too easy in my mind, coming from the Walter Reeds and really getting that intense like care and training and mentorship. But yeah, essentially the same, just ensuring that, you know, I understand their environment. It's a little bit different, but pretty much the same. That's one question that always comes up is, what we're doing in the Army, is that the same as out on the outside? And it pretty much is. If you're doing it here, you'll be able to do it on the outside. If not, just as easy, better.
Okay. Now, you just let us know that you are currently working up there at U of L Hospital. What's that experience been like for you, and how long have you been working at U of L?
So I just took that job on PRN, and like I said, it was just shocking to me. I was, like, so nervous, like, going on the outside, and, you know, how will it be different or how may it be the same? But I found it great to know once I got out there. I want to say there weren't even that many nurses that were certified were in the Army. That's pretty much a major thing, because along with that certification does come some knowledge that you understand or some type of skill set that you've developed.
Right.
So it was neat to get out there where I thought I wouldn't have what it takes, but come out to be one of the only certified nurses in the OR that I'm working in, doing procedures that are way beyond and way more advanced than what they've seen, and actually having someone come to me and say, hey, we saw you did robotics at Walter Reed. We don't have a robot yet, but we would love for you to be on board when we try and get one. So feeling that value, like they see value in me because of something the Army taught me to do, is just really been neat.
Okay, so how do you balance working here in the Army and working up at U of L? How do you balance the two?
So just being, like I said, the status of being PRN, and if you feel like doing it, you feel like it. There's a required amount of hours that you must complete within a certain couple of weeks. However, they understand I'm on active duty, so just communicating things that you learn in the Army.
Okay.
Planning around it to know, okay, hey, maybe this is a longer holiday weekend. I'll use this time to go ahead and work when things have slowed down here. But that's it. Just planning around it, communicating with your outside employer.
And then it happened. That's good right there. That's good. Shout out to you. Shout out to U of L for that.
Yeah, shout out to you. They are a military family too. Cool.
Perioperative nursing has three phases. The perioperative phase, I want to make sure I'm saying this right, the intraoperative phase and the postoperative phase. Talk about the different phases and what your duties are during each phase.
So, like I said, essentially in residency, you get a touch point of all of it. My main position was the intraoperative period, which is where the actual surgical procedure is taking place.
Okay.
However, there's been days that I was cross-trained to work in the preoperative space. So that's anywhere from when the patient, it even starts beyond that when they're just talking with their provider or a surgeon about the upcoming procedure. There's education that may go on. There's coordination between those nurses and that preoperative phase in that patient.
Okay.
Day of procedure, them checking in the morning, they're coming in their civilian clothes and getting them prepared for the procedure. So once again, just re-educating them, ensuring that they're aware of what's going to take place for the day, trying to take care of their family members as well, because the family members are concerned typically and they may be the caretakers, and then preparing them for the intraoperative stage. So that may be doing different lab testing. There may be some pre-surgical prep that they're doing there, whether it's some type of topical, like antimicrobial they're having to put on or anything like that they may be doing there. They'll insert their IVs and whatever before they get to us. And then we'll have a – surgery is, I would say it is high stakes, but with competent, educated providers, it's totally fine. But, you know, we never forget it is high stakes. So with that, there are several checks that happen along the way. So that preoperative period, then in the intraoperative phase, I'll still come out and then once again go over the checklist again, once again re-educate the patient, once again check for certain potential, I wouldn't say hazards, but, yeah, just thoroughly checking again before they're in that intraoperative period. And then when they come out in the recovery period, there's a nurse there then kind of deal with maybe any kind of pain that they're dealing with, help them get to a point to where they're ready for discharge, doing that observation to make sure that they're safe for that, if that's going to be the case, or if not, preparing them for a floor where they would need to be stable before arriving on a floor.
Okay. Now, I don't know if you had to deal with this, but you may have some knowledge on it, but maintaining a sterile environment is crucial in the medical and surgical settings to prevent to prevent infections and ensure patient safety. What sterile techniques do you practice to ensure an environment is free from all microorganisms?
So as I stated, it kind of starts even before the procedure takes place. That is the role of the nurse. That's why I said controlling everything or the chaos in that way. And that's what it is. You're the eyes because the surgical tech is kind of set on setting up the instruments for the procedure. The surgeon is thinking about preparing to actually do the procedure. So you're kind of the eyes for everyone where they may miss something. If something becomes unsterile in a way, you're the one to be able to like kind of be those eyes and call that out, replace what they may need.
Okay.
ensuring people are sticking to the standards, being aware of standards. And that's one thing that people don't understand is as a nurse, you're going to always stay up with the latest literature and best practices. And that's part of that certification piece. Mm-hmm. They're always disseminating what is the best way to prepare a patient for surgery. What are the best ways to reduce infection and just staying in that knowledge, ensuring that everyone that's a part of that team is adhering to that as well. So overall, the patient, like I said, has the safest procedure and the best outcome coming out of that.
Now, have you ever thought of moving from the perioperative nurse to becoming one of the surgeons?
Well, funny enough, as I stated, how I initially got an interest in healthcare was I got to be a doctor. I got to take care of my grandmother,
right?
So I'm happy to say I'm making good on that promise. I just recently got accepted or got assured admission to medical school at the University of Louisville through a post-bac program. So once again, the beauty of the Army, had the support of my amazing commander here, some of my peers here. I've got a physician that I work with. They definitely helped me through that process of applying. And most people don't know about the post-bac route. So essentially, because I already had a career, University of Louisville had a program for career changers where if you met certain criteria with standardized testing, GPA, you could apply for admission up front for medical school. And then they take 10 students and work them through the other prereqs that they would owe. And then you just matriculate straight into medical school.
Man, let's give another round of applause to Captain Weekly. Going back to school. She's back in it again. Let's give her a round of applause for that. And congratulations on that, man. I always like to say that.
Since 1775, Army chaplains have acted as spiritual counselors who support, motivate, and provide emotional guidance to soldiers and their families. We are looking for chaplains to care for spiritual, moral, and emotional well-being of the Army. Follow your calling as an Army chaplain. Visit goarmy.com/chaplain. For more information or to speak with one of our virtual recruiters today.
Now, you spoke about this earlier, but I want to ask you again because you may have a different answer to it after we've had this conversation. But when it comes to your job, what aspect gives you the most fulfillment? Now, earlier you said speaking to the students. Is there any other aspects of the job that give you fulfillment?
Any day that I'm making impact, that's actually my prayer. I'm always telling God, please, whatever I'm doing, let it be impactful. Mm-hmm. So whether it's talking to someone and just giving them a little bit of hope, whether it's picking up the phone later in the evening to help talk someone through a situation they don't understand and I may understand it, whether it's helping my command team here by delivering an op order that did some successful training, whatever it is, as long as it's of an impact, that's fulfilling in me at the end of the day.
Talk about some of those other possibilities that you have explored while serving in the U.S. Army, and how would those experiences benefit you outside of the Army?
Just things like this, reaching out on a limb and doing operations, which is so distinctly different from nursing. I remember when I took the job on, I was flat out honest. I was like, I don't know how to do any of that. But what I will tell you is I'll learn. Mm-hmm. So just having that courage to try is going to carry me even on the outside, like I said, in the future as a future physician, hopefully with, you know, successfully completing medical school. Right. Just that willingness to try and do something to better myself or to serve others.
Now, if you could give a medical student advice, any advice, what would that be? I guess this would be some advice that you would be giving to yourself, too, mm-hmm. since you're back in medical school.
Be courageous and believe in yourself, because I think a lot of the times because you're so close because you've at least jumped into the waters, mm-hmm. but you're still so far. Just continue your path. You know what you want it to do, and just stick with it.
Okay. June. This month is June, and it's the 249th birthday of the U.S. Army. How many more Army birthdays will you celebrate before retiring?
Oh, at least 10, because I'll be an HBSB recipient. Okay. So at least 10, because with that is the obligation 4 years at least after residency.
Okay. When the day is over, the uniform comes off, and you're at home with family, highlight some of your hobbies and interests outside of the service.
Being with family. Absolutely. I've got my brother at home with me now and my younger sister visiting for the summer. And that's just the best, is being with my family.
Being with family. Can't ever beat being with family. Last question that I have for you. What message would you like to leave future generations who will hear this interview?
I mean, I guess it's just like I said, if you're going to be in this world, do something to better the world. Mm-hmm. Do something to serve others. And live the best life you possibly can for yourself.
Okay. Now, before we get out of here, is there any other thing that you would like to leave the AMED Effect, any gems, any knowledge, anything that you would like to leave the listeners and viewers?
I would just wish that you have several more episodes, because we're bringing in several more healthcare providers, because somebody's got to replace me.
All right. Well, that's it, y'all. Thank you guys for tuning in to the AMED Effect. Again, this is episode 9. I have Captain Weekly here. Make sure that you all tune in and listen to this episode, and be sure to share, like, comment, and spread the AMED Effect to people who may find this content interesting. The causes and effects of Army medical opportunities are endless. When you join the U.S. Army Medical Department, not only will you get more out of your medical career, but you will also provide meaningful service to soldiers, their families, military retirees, and last but not least, your country. To learn more about AMED, visit goarmy.com/AMED. That's goarmy.com/AMED. And if you're looking for information on tuition assistance, visit goarmy.com/HPSP. That's goarmy.com/HPSP.